Support for NPR podcasts comes from Bose. Bose sound in a portable iPod speaker system. Learn more about the SoundDock portable music system at Bose.com.
From the Lord. That's the best way to put it, because nobody could play like that band. And everybody will tell you that. When they were on, nobody could come close. And when you have that, you have to go to the leader. Without a leader like him, you don't have that.
Louis Belson was one of Duke Ellington's favorite drummers. What he remembers about the Ellington band, what it was like to play in, what it was like to listen to, is a shared view. Nearly every one of Ellington's players has looked back on the experience with awe. Just what was it that created this special sound? What was the secret ingredient? The sound was Ellington's handiwork, his brainchild. But it was also the product of his players, the sum of their talents and personalities, and the regional touches that each brought to it. A blend created by highly independent-minded people. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, our second look into the genius of Duke Ellington, the band leader. Ellington didn't just lead America's premier jazz orchestra for 50 years. He studied the personalities and skills of his players and created a musical world for them to shine in. Their personalities became part of the band's signature sound, the result of an intimate personal exchange of musical ideas on the bandstand. And the fact that many musicians stayed in the band for so long gave a wonderful continuity to that carefully crafted Ellingtonian sound. Conductor and educator, David Baker.
When you played with Duke, there was no way to go but down if you went to another orchestra. Once you had ever been integrated into that sound, it's something that was very difficult to replicate with anybody else. And then there was the loyalty, love, and practicalities.
Most of those who left wound up returning. They discovered that playing Ellington's music under Ellington's leadership was where they thrived best and felt most appreciated. Trumpeter Clark Terry.
There was a feeling of being a part of the royal family, so to speak, when you became a member of the band. You really felt good, you know, not better than other people, but you just felt good and happy to be a part of this organization. Sometimes the band was referred to as the New York Yankees. Here come the Yankees.
Ellington handled his musicians with the utmost care and respect. He paid them well and put up with a lot. Maybe in part because he needed them. They were his instrument, his means to test the viability of his vision. And his ideas demanded the highest quality musicianship. Nothing less would do.
And he always would say two things. One was that there are only two kinds of music. It's good music and bad music. And I prefer to be associated with good music, of course. Whenever any situation came up as to what he preferred or what he wanted or what he said, oh, for me, I'm very, very easy to please. Just give me the best.
There's no question that the band members needed Ellington. He was unique among composers for having shaped so many of his compositions to suit the talents of his musicians. He brought out their brilliance. He cared deeply about the quality of their playing, and he was generous with his praise. But he went further. In writing specifically for his soloist, he developed them as musicians, got them to grow into their talents. Conductor and arranger, David Berger.
Ellington was great at taking players that in someone else's band, either they didn't fit or they were just other players in other people's bands, not real stars. But in his band, they became stars. He knew how to find the special qualities each person had and develop those through his music. And he taught the players in his band who they were. That's Clark's Harry said, Duke Ellington taught us who we were. Some players, like Paul Gonsalves, joined the band, and Paul Gonsalves was a ballad player. He played the greatest ballads, and Duke made him into the up-tempo player. He was great at it, but nobody knew that before. Duke saw this in him. Same thing, Johnny Hodges, when he joined the band, he was known as great fast player. He was very fiery, and Duke made him into the greatest ballad player of all time.
Ellington managed to get things out of his musicians that they didn't know they had in them. Once, he asked Clark Terry to portray legendary New Orleans trumpeter Buddy Bolden.
When we did A Drum as a Woman, he said to me, Sweetie, you're going to portray the role of Buddy Bolden. So I said, well, Maestro, I don't know anything about Buddy Bolden. I said, you don't even know that much about Buddy. He was waiting for you. They said, oh, sure, you know Buddy Bolden. We all knew Buddy Bolden. He said, he was suave. He was debonair. And said in his tone, he had a big, fat tone, and he loved to bend notes, and he could play diminishes like nobody in the world. Meanwhile, he's psyching you into all these things. And he said he would tune up in New Orleans and break glasses across the river in Algiers. He's so powerful. So he said, just play me some bent notes and some diminishes, and let me see. I bet you are Buddy Bolden. And I played it. He said, that's it? You are Buddy Bolden. And I thought I was Buddy Bolden, man.
Who's the Met King this year? Buddy Bolden is his name, and blowing the horn is his game. Born with a silver trumpet in his mouth. Played the horn before he talked. Born on the afterbeat. He patted his foot before he walked. Then Buddy Bolden tuned up, you could hear him across the river. He woke up the working people and kept up the easy liver. Call him Buddy Bolden. Calling his flock. Here they come.
Trumpeter Clark Terry playing the role of legendary Buddy Bolden in Ellington's A Drum is a Woman, recorded in 1956. One thing Ellington never did was try to force-fit a player into a style that wasn't right for him or her. Duke Ellington in 1962.
I always say that we are primitive artists. We only employ the materials at hand. And when someone comes in, just like when Kay Davis came in, she was a soprano, so we employed her in her natural character. And the band is an accumulation of personalities, tonal devices, you know, and as a result of a certain musician applied to a certain instrument, you get a definite tonal character.
I'll forget you, I will, while yet you are still burning inside my brain. Romance is mush, stifling those who strive. I'll live a lush life in some small dive. And there I'll be while I rot with the rest of those whose lives are lonely too.
Kay Davis with Ellington's only performance of Billy Strayhorn's masterpiece, Lush Life. Singer Joya Sherrill was so young when she started with Ellington, she was still finding a style. Ellington was careful to encourage her to develop in her own way.
Duke said to me when I first joined the band, because he knew I knew nothing about the business, he said, I want you to watch as many singers as you can. Listen to every singer there is. And if you hear something that's good, then I want you to work with that, you know, the good things, until you compile all these things and you'll have your own style.
Kiss me sweet, smooth, and conclude. No weak squeak, get on the beam. Sweet, smooth, and conclusively, must be good to play on my home team. When I order chicken, I don't want the gizzard. When I go a fishing, a minnow won't do. You must be a standout, a whirlwind, a wizard. Gotta be the champ, or else you're through. Kiss me long, strong, and consecutive. No short snort will suit me, Jack. Long, strong, and consecutive. Hold me close like aces back to back.
Joya Sherrill in 1945 with Long, Strong, and Consecutive. It's a look into the genius of Duke Ellington, the band leader, on NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson.
Kiss me long. No short snort will suit me, Jack. Long, strong, and consecutive. Hold me close like aces back to back.
Ellington's music was so highly tailored to his musicians, their names even appeared in his scores. Clark Terry.
When they pass out the music, you don't see first, second, third trumpet. You see, like, Cat Anderson, Rex, Ray Nance, or Clark, or Willie Cook, or Shorty Baker, Quentin Jackson, and so forth, and Rabbit, and Butter, and so forth. All these people's names were on the part.
And just as often, there were no names at all, because there was no music. Ellington never wrote out drum parts, believing the rhythm section should play spontaneously. Louis Belson.
There was no drum book in the Ellington band. No piano book, no drum book. Everybody else had a book, but no drums, no piano. So I immediately, one of the first guys I approached was Clark Terry. And I said, Clark, is there anything that you guys want to say to me about, you know, I see a concert coming up and we're going to play different things. Oh yeah, you'll dig it, Lou, you'll dig it. I said, yeah, I know I'm going to dig it, but don't you want to say something? I have no music and don't worry about it. I got this from Cat Anderson. I got this from Harry Carney. I finally went to the boss. I went to Ellington, and Ellington said, don't worry about a thing, just watch me. And that's right, all I had to do was watch him. He gave me all the cues. He made me use every fiber in my body.
heart of Duke's ensemble is the rhythm section.
David Berger.
He liked his rhythm section to have like a very simple foundation, a simple structure, and then they could feel free to do what they felt on that structure. Somebody asked him, how much information do you give the bass player? And he said, as little as possible.
In spite of Ellington's paternal approach to his band, the band itself could be less than nurturing to new members. You had to earn your place. Clark Terry.
Yeah, well, the first time I joined the band was kind of a strange situation because Duke had a system of notifying the group what was being played through the medium of the introduction that he would make. He'd make a little thing like, and all the guys would start digging for the music. Well, I wouldn't be aware of what this was, so I had to look around and wait, and I'd ask her, what's he playing? And they'd say, I don't know. They wouldn't tell you anything, you know. They kind of made it, made you earn your being there. You know, the old saying was, don't put your laundry in for a year, because you may not stay there.
Staying with the Ellington Orchestra was a decision few musicians took lightly. But it was their commitment to the maestro that made Ellington's music all the more compelling. For instance, Ellington pushed the art of blending as far as it could go with his innovative trombone section. He used three, each totally different from the other. Trombonist John Sanders.
Each one of them had a style. Each one of them had a tone color. Lawrence Brown had a beautiful trombone tone, and he could play in the upper register. Juan Tizol's valve trombone was more in the middle register, a darker sound, like listening to a violin and then listening to a viola or the upper cello range. And of course, Tricky Sam's solos with the plunger were unique, and Duke could write for them as a trio of trombones, and the sound that came out was just gorgeous. Lawrence on the top, and Juan in the middle, and Tricky on the bottom.
Superb sound, called by Billy Strayhorn the Ellington Effect, could overwhelm audiences and professionals alike. Clark Terry.
I don't think that anyone has ever been more creative than the Maestro Ellington. I could hear those beautiful harmonic sounds, and when I had an opportunity to hear this band, I was just carried away each time.
Louis Belson recalls band leader Stan Kenton's reaction to the Effect.
I remember one time we had a battle of bands with Stan Kenton in Revere, Mass. Stan Kenton was supposed to go on first, then Duke Ellington. Well, we got there early, and Stan called in. He was about 100 miles away. They had a bus problem. So the promoter said, Duke, you mind starting first? So Duke said, no, not at all. So we started. By the time Duke pulled out Harry Carney solo, Clark Terry solo, Jimmy Hamilton solo, Paul Gonzalez solo, Cat Anderson, all these bombastic solos, and by that time, Stan's bus was pulling up, and all the band crowded around the bandstand, and their tongues were hanging out listening to the band. So when we finished, Stan Kenton got right up on the bandstand and said, ladies and gentlemen, there's nothing for us to do. Duke did it all.
Despite the orchestra's success, by the late 1940s, another jazz form called bebop was replacing the swing-era big band jazz, and rhythm and blues was becoming a staple of American musical culture. But Ellington wouldn't consider dismantling his unit. Quite the opposite. He mortgaged his financial future to ensure the continued ability to create the great music he knew would endure, as you'll soon hear. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, our second look into the genius of Duke Ellington, the band leader, from NPR, National Public Radio. Duke Ellington called music his mistress. Nothing mattered more to him than to ensure that his relationship with it continued to grow. During the lean years of the late 1940s and early 50s, this became a challenge as he was forced to redefine his mission. No one knew better than drummer Louis Belson the primary reason for the Ellington Band's existence. Ellington needed to hear his music played as soon as he wrote it.
When Ellington wrote something, he had to hear it right away. So every night on the bandstand, you would see a new piece of manuscript paper. Maybe it would be 16 bars, sometimes only 4 bars, and he would say, "Now I'll play this 4 bars." He wanted to hear that structure, that mesh, that sound with the brass or the reeds, and if it was good, you'd see an extension of that.
Composer and conductor Gunther Schuller.
I mean, sometimes the ideas were not even written down. He might remember them, and he would simply dictate them to some key players. Hodges, you take the melody, and let's say this piece is now in D flat major. Harry, what are you going to do here, you know, to accompany Hodges? Something like that, sort of almost dictating a mere 8 bars, which then maybe a week later got expanded further into a piece or half a piece.
And in somewhere, like we were playing a dance, Duke would incorporate this new piece into the dance set.
Trombonist John Sanders.
And the audience wasn't even aware what was happening. There was no title on it. Most of the time, just names: Britt, Butter, Johnny, Harry, Jimmy, Ray, Clark Terry. I would just put the names on their parts, pass it out, and they would sight read it. They were wonderful readers. They, working with Duke, they knew how to respond to him. And Duke didn't make a fuss, you know. He had the greatest trust and confidence in the musicians.
In spite of loyalty to Ellington, in spite of respect for his leadership, in spite of admiration for his music, a great reality underlay the reason why so many in the band stuck by him year after year, and Ellington knew it all too well. Ellington, in a 1963 interview.
What is the secret of keeping a band together for as long as you do?
Because you've got to have a gimmick. It's the one I use. I mean, I use a gimmick. Huh?
Yeah.
Just give him money.
He kept his band together even when they weren't working.
Ellington's friend, Marion Logan.
He kept them and paid them, because his only mission was to have some instrument that would play back what he had written.
Unlike many of the big bands, which played only on weekends, Ellington's orchestra was on the payroll 52 weeks a year, whether they had play dates or not. Some musicians felt this was too constraining, like Ellington's star alto saxophonist, Johnny Hodges. Johnny Hodges was paid more than anyone else in the band, but was not shy about asking for more. After a particularly good solo, he would look at Ellington and rub the fingers of one hand together, hinting that he wanted a bonus. Their relationship was a rocky one, but Ellington came to rely on Hodges' mastery of the blues, his way with ballads, and phenomenal ability as an improviser. The quiet loner, everyone called Rabbit, finally left the band in 1951 to try his luck running his own band. And he was only one of a number who left to pursue other interests. Gunther Schuller.
The difference between their talents and his is proven by the fact that when some of these great players left him in the 40s and in the 50s and made their own careers, guess what? They weren't that successful individually. And eventually, they all came back, including, by the way, Johnny Hodges, who was the main complainer.
Defections were a problem. They disturbed the finely tuned balance of the band. But knowing that his music was only as good as his players were, Ellington was always resourceful about finding replacements. He built his sound around a core group of distinctive voices, adapting their colorations into his own music. As early as 1929, when his fabled trumpeter Bubber Miley became ill, Ellington replaced him with 17-year-old Cootie Williams, who became a legend in his own right, flutist and composer James Newton.
Cootie Williams, who was a master of the plunger, even though he didn't want to, he sort of took Bubber Miley's place in the band and learned to use the plunger in a whole other way. I like to look at the versions of East St. Louis Toodaloo that Miley did in the late 20s, and then you listen to Cootie Williams' version in 1937. And it's so gut bucket, it's so blues oriented, it's so much funk in it. You know, if they put a hip hop beat behind it, it might become a million seller, you know.
This is Cootie Williams in 1937 on East St. Louis Toodaloo. And this was his predecessor, Bubba Miley, in 1927. Trumpeters Bubba Miley and Cootie Williams with their distinct versions of East St. Louis Toodaloo. Another 17-year-old recruited by Ellington was Harry Carney, a virtuoso on what was then an unusual instrument in jazz, the baritone sax, Gunther Schuller.
The arrival of Harry Carney is another one of these threshold points in the band's career and in Ellington's career. At that time, hardly anybody used a baritone saxophone. And Carney had a particularly rich, vibrant sound, vivid sound, that Ellington exploited to the hilt.
Their relationship is one of the most interesting in the history of music.
Trumpeter and band leader Wynton Marsalis.
He stayed in Duke Ellington's band for 50 years. I mean, just to stay with one person playing jazz for 50 years, man, that kind of loyalty is unprecedented. I think Duke really, really relied on him and depended on him. So I think Carney was the cornerstone of that band. And from what I feel about him, just from hearing him play, he was a certain type of man. Like that big deacon in the back of the church that everybody always knows is there. Harry Carney, he was something.
Baritone saxophonist Harry Carney was slap happy. Ellington tried to be ethical about hiring players away from other band leaders. He insisted drummer Louis Belson get band leader Harry James permission before leaving him, along with two other band members, trombonist Juan Tizal and saxophonist Willie Smith. The answer was unexpected.
In those days, it was not right to rob somebody from another band, and especially Ellington didn't like to do that. So when he spoke to Tizal Ellington said, I understand you got a pretty good drummer with the band. He said, now, I'm not going to steal him, but is he available? So Teasel said, well, let me find out. He said, find out about Willie Smith, too. So anyway, the three of us went up to Harry James. Juan Teasel said, we have a chance to join Duke Ellington, the three of us. Harry James looked at all three of us and pondered the situation and then finally said, take me with you. That was his count. I'll never forget it. And he said, go. He said, I hate to lose you, but go ahead. You got my blessings.
Throughout the entire history of the band, Duke Ellington had made it a point to handpick and develop promising soloists, gradually building his ensemble and its sound. Clarinetist Barney Bigard, who joined in 1928, featured a soaring and reedy tone. He and bassist Wellman Brough brought a New Orleans-flavored blues quality to the orchestra. Barney Bigard on clarinet lament. Diminutive trumpeter Freddie Jenkins also came aboard in 1928, enlarging the brass section to four, three trumpets and a trombone. By that year, Ellington had 11 instruments he could write for, which allowed him to expand his band sound into a new musical arena. In 1929, Ellington added a second trombonist to his brass section, Juan Teasel, who played the valve trombone, a rarity in jazz ensembles. In 1931, Ellington hired his first full-time vocalist, Ivy Anderson. She brought yet another dimension to the band, and not only with just her voice. Pianist and author Dempsey Travis.
Ivy Anderson, oh God, yes. She was 110 pounds soaking wet, but she was dynamite. She had so much personality. Not only did she have personality, but she was a comedian. Good voice. But funny. And of course, she and Greer would talk back and forth to each other. I can just see her now. She could just talk a song and make you get chills.
He don't love me like I love him. Nobody could. I got it bad. Like a lonely weeping willow, long.
Ivy Anderson in 1941. It's a look into the genius of Duke Ellington, the band leader, on NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson. When Ellington hired trombonist Lawrence Brown in 1932, he became the first band leader with three trombones in his band. This trio helped create that so-called Ellington effect. Chosen for the elegant, lyrical, cello-like style that he had developed back in Los Angeles, Brown became Ellington's lead trombone player. Trombonist Lawrence Brown with Yearning for Love. Duke Ellington continued his restless search for new kinds of instrumental sounds to add to his composing palette. In 1934, he found a new one that really intrigued him. Cornetist Rex Stewart came aboard, replacing Freddie Jenkins. Conductor and arranger, David Berger.
The cornet has three valves that you press down, and in order to make the notes sound, you need to press them down all the way. But Rex would have a way of playing where he would press them down halfway. And Ellington would write pieces for him so that he could do that. This is a great piece called Boy Meets Horn from 1938, which uses this technique, and it's very comical.
Rex Stewart on cornet in 1938 with Boy Meets Horn. In 1939 came one of the most unusual voices of all. Ellington confidant Gene Bock recalls her first meeting with bassist Jimmy Blanton.
I was at the first session that Jimmy Blanton ever made. He hadn't joined the band yet. And Duke said, when the session was over, stick around because you'll see something that will surprise you. He said, it's a bass player who plays in tune. And out came this tall, skinny guy with a kind of zoot suit with wide white stripes. And he looked like a clown, you know. I thought, what's going on? And he got up to the bass, and he and Duke just did these duets. And shortly thereafter, Jimmy Blanton did join the band.
Blanton was only 20 years old and technically dazzling. In 1940, the celebrated Kansas City tenor saxophonist Ben Webster joined Ellington. Together with Blanton, He added a driving rhythmic sound and unparalleled virtuosity to the orchestra. Reaching one of its highest musical peaks that year, it came to be known as the Blanton-Webster Band. Singer Herb Jeffries.
There was a communication between Blanton and Webster like I have never seen between two musicians. Of course, both of them had probably magna ears. These were men who could hear a tune one time and remember it forever, to such an extent that they became tied in friendship between them. As a matter of fact, Webster was sort of like very protective to Blanton, so there was a camaraderie between them that was unique.
Webster gave Ellington a fifth saxophone to write for, and a highly distinct one. Ellington biographer Barry Ulanoff.
That somebody like Ben Webster could sit in his band, that really moved Duke enormously. And this was a voice from the other world, from the swing world that he never quite made his world. And he looked for voices. Here were voices he'd never heard before in his band, in his setting, so to speak, in his traveling home, which was his real home.
Now, the orchestra was beginning to swing more than ever before. By 1942, Ellington's two vocalists, Ivy Anderson and the debonair Herb Jeffries, would leave the band. Ellington found a new vocal quality in Al Hibbler, who was blind. Gene Bach.
You never got the feeling that Hibbler was a disabled person. Albert Hibbler was blind, but he would come on stage arm in arm with Ellington. Ellington would have his arm around Hibbler's shoulders and make wild gestures with the free hand that he had, telling probably some terribly dirty, salacious story, hilarious story to Hibbler. So Hibbler would be convulsed, and Ellington would be flailing this one free arm and holding his other arm to guide Hibbler to the microphone. So Hibbler was in good spirits when he got to the microphone, and it just tickled Duke.
Ain't got the change of a nickel. Ain't got no bounce in my shoe. Ain't got no fancy to tickle. I ain't got nothing but the blues. Ain't got no coffee that's perfect. Ain't got no winnings to lose. Ain't got a dream that is working. I ain't got nothing but the blues.
Perhaps the most versatile and virtuoso talent of all joined the band in 1940 after Cootie Williams left. His name was Ray Nance. David Berger.
Ray Nance was an unusual member of Ellington's band in that his nickname was Floor Show. That was because he could do everything. He sang, he danced, he played the trumpet, later the cornet, and also the violin. Violin is a very unusual instrument, we think, in jazz, but in the hands of Ray Nance, there's no question that this is a jazz instrument.
It was Nance's soaring open trumpet solo that highlighted the Victor version of Take the A-Train from 1941. It made him a star. By the end of World War II, profound musical changes would occur in the country. Suddenly, it was no longer economically feasible to support a big band. Dance halls were closing, people were starting families, and popular music was changing. Many of Ellington's former stars, who had left the band years earlier, were now unhappy in their work. In the early 1950s, Ellington welcomed back Johnny Hodges and Juan Teasel. Once again, he was assembling and honing the nucleus of a powerhouse band. By the mid-1950s, Ellington was entering the final and perhaps most creative period of his life. Other major new talents had joined the band, among them tenor saxophonist Paul Gonsalves. His 27 consecutive solos at the 1956 Newport Jazz Festival sparked Ellington's explosive comeback and the rebirth of interest in his work. Composer and flutist James Newton.
You have one of the most sophisticated harmonic players in the 20th century in the name of Paul Gonsalves, who was just a genius as far as harmony is concerned and what he was able to do, because Paul had so much of Ben Webster in his playing, and at the same time he was a master of the bebop style and really did a lot of other things that were very forward looking.
Other great new players included trumpeter Cat Anderson, trombonist Quentin Butter Jackson and Booty Wood, drummer Louis Belson, and clarinetist Jimmy Hamilton and Russell Prokop. By the late 1950s, Ellington was back on a roll, and he knew it. He became more energetic and prolific than ever. The level of musicianship he now commanded almost surpassed anything previously heard. Singer Joya Sherrill, who performed with Ellington intermittently from the early 1940s through the late 1960s, recalls the frequent sight of Ellington pushing his musicians to discover new heights.
He actually emoted energy. I mean, he would bounce around and he would speak to the musicians as they're working and make them work and make them play. He would call them up and say, one more, you know, and he had a little sound he'd make when he was enjoying it, you know. And it was inspirational. The guys would just work their heads off.
Duke Ellington's creative fire continued right up to his death in 1974. He never lost the desire to lead his orchestra, which had been the vehicle for his creative expression for almost 50 years. His granddaughter, Mercedes Ellington.
When people would ask him when he would retire, he would say, retire to what? Which, when you think about it, if you're in this particular type of business of making sounds, creating music, what do you retire to? Do you just stop hearing those things in your head? It doesn't happen like that.
Joya Sherrill.
This is a man who never took time off. He, at the restaurant, would be thinking of a melody and writing it on the napkin. He would be in the bus traveling and he's working on a tune. He really never rested from his creative work. Even God on the seventh day rested. But he's resting now.
Louis Belson.
The band to him meant more than anything else in the world. That was it. That was his tool. That was his means of hearing his music. That was his life.
Throughout his band-leading career, Duke Ellington assembled some of history's greatest jazz interpreters. He carefully nurtured their talents, and in doing so, expanded the horizons of jazz beyond what anybody had envisioned. Together, this band and bandleader created a voice that will never be duplicated. Theirs is a sublime and lasting achievement. Our look into the genius of Duke Ellington is written and produced for Jazz Profiles by Robert Levy. The executive producer is Tim Owens. The studio producer for this program is Molly Murphy. Associate producer, John McDonald. Assistant producers are Jennifer Raskin and Madeline Smith. Post-production engineer, Rima Snyder, with help from Todd Hulslander. We'd like to say thanks to our lead advisor, John Edward Hassey. Also, Susan Jenkins, Phil Schaap, Patrick Breslin, producer Margaret Howells and NPR's Making the Music, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the Smithsonian's Duke Ellington Archives and their Jazz Oral History Program, and NPR's New York and Los Angeles bureaus. Special thanks to the New York Foundation for the Arts and to the New York State Council on the Arts for their support. This program is a production of National Public Radio in association with Smithsonian Productions, made possible in part by a grant from America's Jazz Heritage, a partnership of the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund and the Smithsonian Institution. To email us, or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts and culture an active part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.